Let me invite you to open your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Dwight, thank you for leading us in those songs. And for those of you that followed the elections, you saw Dwight Samuel's name on the roster for the school board at Rogersville. And not only saw his name there, he garnered the largest number of votes of the candidates. So he is serving again in the community of Rogersville, and we're proud of him for that, the community service that he's providing. We come to chapter 7, and I don't relish coming to chapter 7. This is a problematic chapter, and I want us to split it in half, partly because this morning, at the end of our service, we're going to see our new deacons installed, and we're having to crunch our time a little bit, and we don't want to have to squeeze this down to just a few minutes, so we're going to divide chapter 7 into two parts. And we're going to begin this morning with just the opening verses, verses 1 through 7. Chapter 7 begins the section in the entire epistle to the Corinthians where Paul begins to respond to specific inquiries that they had written to him about. When we began this study, in chapters 1 through 6, we saw that Paul dealt with problems that he had heard about. Chloe's household, they were primarily problems with various kinds of division within the body. And so chapters 1 through 6, Paul deals with all these things he'd heard about, the divisions that were occurring. But now in chapter 7, all the way through until the end of the epistle, Paul is going to respond to apparently what was written correspondence. That's why he begins there in chapter 7 with the phrase, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote." So he'll deal with written correspondence, and he addresses a series of questions, and it's almost like he says, okay, here's the first thing you ask about, here's the second thing you ask about, here's the third thing you ask about, and you see these sections from chapter 7 through chapter 16. In chapter 7, verse 1, he says, "Now about the matters you wrote about," and he deals with marriage and divorce issues. In chapter 8, verse 1, he says, "Now about food sacrificed to idols," and then he deals with that issue. In chapter 12, verse 1, he says, "Now about spiritual gifts," and then he deals with that issue. And finally, in chapter 16, verse 1, he says, "Now about the collection for God's people," and then he deals with that issue. So we're going to be getting into issues here in the end of our study of Corinthians. Let me just do a quick overview of chapter 7, and then we're going to come back, as I said, and look specifically at the first seven verses. Verses 1 through 7, he deals about intimacy and marriage. In verse 8, he addresses the unmarried and the widows. In verse 10, he addresses the married couples there in the Corinthian church. In verses 12 and following, he addresses the rest, and we're going to see that the rest he's talking to there are people who are married to non-Christians. And then in verse 25, he addresses virgins. And then he sort of comes back around to the subject he began with in chapter 7 in the closing verses of that chapter. So that's the way we're going to break this up and look at it. And hopefully next week we'll be able to move through the remainder of the chapter. Now let me remind you, the church in Corinth was a little island of holy people in the midst of a corrupt society. The church there was set in the midst of a seaport city with its brothels, its immorality, its temples to goddesses that promoted sexuality of the most flagrant kind. And so here the church is, and they're struggling. They're swimming against the current of a very pagan, very immoral society. And so you can almost forgive them for apparently what's taking place here. It's always been the tendency of mankind from the very beginning to try to do one-upmanship with God. If God says, "Don't do this," then we say, "Well, I can do better than that, and I'll build hedges around that law, and I'll do even better. If God says fast one day out of the year, the Pharisees will say, well, we can do better than that. We'll fast twice a week. And so it's always the tendency of God's people to want to do even more, and if we're not careful to bind those things we're doing on others, to go beyond what is written. So these people apparently in Corinth had seen the immorality around them. They knew God's call to live holy lives. And so some in the church in Corinth were saying, you know, we would do better if we just completely lived celibate lives. Let's just get away from any danger of temptation in this area for sin, and let's just live celibate lives. And apparently there were some who were even promoting that within marriage. So Paul begins by quoting their letter. He says, now concerning the things about which you wrote, and it's my understanding that he is simply now quoting them at this point. And he gives this quote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, I generally use the New International Version. This morning I'm not using that. I'm using the New American Standard Version for the simple reason that the NIV has it wrong here. Any commentator you read will tell you that. They mistranslate this by saying it is good for a man not to marry. Marriage is not what's being talked about here. It's talking about the sexual relationship. One commentator puts it very well. He says the phrase that he uses here, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, is a slogan of someone who is anti-sex, not anti-marriage. And so I'm using what I believe to be the correct translation, where Paul quotes the slogan, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, the Corinthian Christians, as I said, came out of a pagan background that was saturated with sexuality. And apparently some were saying, it's just a better thing for us to be completely celibate. That way we don't have to worry about any danger of being caught up in sexual sin. Well, Paul immediately counters such advice. And for the very same reason that drove them to come up with this slogan of not touching a woman. Paul says, you say that because there's so much immorality, you should just absolutely abstain. And he says, I say that because there's so much immorality, you need to get a partner with which you can be sexually fulfilled. So that was Paul's solution. That's what he's going to say here in these opening verses. And I want to just add this. You know, it's a shame that historically there have been religious groups and religious people who have insisted that a celibate life is a more holy life than a married life. That finds no substance anywhere in Scripture. Marriage was God's idea from the beginning. It was God who said to Adam in the garden, it is not good for man to be alone. And then he made a helpmeet for him. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, it was God who gave the command to man and woman to be fruitful and to multiply. The Hebrew writer in 13:4 says, marriage should be honored by all, in the marriage bed kept pure. Now Paul talks about the responsibility here in this section, the responsibility of husband and wife to one another in this area of intimacy. And so rather than going the opposite direction and throwing the baby out with the bath, Paul says no. He says you do live in a corrupt society, but marriage is a blessing to God's people, enabling them to live a fulfilled life and to not be tempted by all the sexual immorality around them. And so he deals with this in these verses. Read with me, if you will. Let's just read the whole section we're going to be looking at, verses 1 through 7. Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but her husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, lest Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But this I say by way of concession, not of command. Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. For either mate, Paul says, to deprive each other sexually opens the door for Satan. I do marriage counseling for all couples that I perform weddings for, and in one of the sections that we go through, I give them a sheet on fighting fair, and I just say, you're going to have fights. If you haven't already, you're going to have fights, and you're going to have some humdingers. And when you get really angry in your marriage, just be sure that when you fight fairly. And there are ways that you can fight fairly, and there are ways that are very unfair. And I bring up all the ways to fight unfairly. You don't drag family into these. Don't ever, in your fight, say, you're just like your mother. I mean, that's off limits. That's not fair. Among the things we talk about, we say it is unfair when you have a fight to withdraw intimacy, to use that as a weapon in your fight, and to cut your spouse off, for the husband to cut his wife off, for the wife to cut her husband off. That's not fighting fair in marriage. That opens the door for Satan to bring temptation. That opens the door for some other person who is very nice and warm and affectionate to step into that marriage, and it's very easy for an affair to begin. So that's not the way that it's to be done. Now, there are a lot of reasons why couples don't meet one another's needs in this particular area. Some of it is just fatigue and busyness and the lives we live. Sometimes it's selfishness, an unwillingness to be inconvenienced. Sometimes in marriages, couples say, you know, I'm just no longer very attracted to my mate, and I'm just not ever in the mood or interested in fulfilling that area of our life. And I've even heard people say, you know, if I don't feel in the mood, that's being emotionally dishonest for me to go through with anything. That's just emotionally dishonest. Tony Campolo, who's a sociologist and a Christian writer, he writes that most couples fall out of love, not in love, out of love, at least 8 times during the course of their marriage. Times when things sort of go down to a low level, and you just don't really enjoy marriage like you did at earlier stages of your marriage. And then things get better, and they'll go a little south again. And I don't know if this is true in the marriages that have existed here and currently exist in this congregation, but he says about 8 times you can expect to see those kinds of things happen where your feelings are just not as high as they once were. But you know something? That's what vows are for. That's why at the beginning you made promises to your spouse, until death do you part. That's what all contracts are for. You know, there are times when things are a little bit tight and I don't really feel like making my house payment. You ever feel like that? But I made a commitment back there at the beginning that every month I would send my check in to the bank, I'd pay my mortgage in a timely fashion, and because I made a promise and because I made a commitment, I do that every month whether I feel like it or not. The rule of thumb for the Christian is don't always allow your feelings to dictate your actions. If you always acted on your feelings in every area of life, can you imagine what life would be like? I can promise you, you wouldn't have any friends left by the end of the year if you always acted on your feelings. We've learned to do better than that. We do the right thing. We do the honorable thing. We rise above our feelings in other areas of life. Paul says, do it in your marriage, in this area of intimacy. Rather than always acting on your feelings, let love have its way. Act in a loving way towards your spouse. In verses 3 and 4, he says it very clearly, let the husband fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Paul expressed this as an obligation to give love to your spouse, not an obligation to demand love. So let's understand. He doesn't say this so that a husband can demand his due or a wife can demand her due. He's talking about giving, free will. The demand is to give, not to seek your own needs. It's a matter of being committed to meet the needs of the one that I promised to love on the day that I married. Now, Paul would write later on in this same epistle in chapter 13 that love is not self-seeking. And that's what he's describing here, a kind of love that is not self-seeking. Again, in marriage counseling, often couples will say, you know, I just don't have the same feelings that I used to have. I don't feel anything anymore for my spouse. And counselors will tell you in books and otherwise that that's one of the easiest things to fix in a marriage because you simply begin to act in a loving way. And feelings always follow actions. So if you're not feeling in a loving way, begin to act in a loving way. And you'll see that soon those feelings will follow the actions of love in a marriage. Now, he talks here about a time when it's okay to deprive each other. In verse 5, what's that talking about? Stop depriving one another, he says, except by agreement for a time that you may devote yourself to prayer and then come together again, lest Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control. First of all, it's by mutual consent. It's an agreement. It's not one partner saying, you know, I'm going to go on a spiritual diet, and so I'm just going to go out here and live a celibate life for a period of months or years. That's not what he's saying. Under the old law, there were times of worship and prayer where one could become ceremonially unclean by having intimate relationships or by touching a dead animal. Or at the time of the month for a woman. And so possibly this is what Paul is referring to. But the point in it all is it's foolish and it is dangerous to go for lengthy periods of time without meeting one another's needs in marriage. It opens the door to outside relationships where someone else is more sensitive to the needs of an individual than their partner is. Now, Paul mentions lastly here in this section, in verse 6, a concession that he's making. He says, I say this by way of concession, not of command. What's he referring to here when he says this is just a concession? I'm not requiring this of everyone. It's by way of concession. Well, my understanding is that he's referring back to what he said in verse 2. He says, every man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. He's talking about marriage. He says, I recommend marriage. In an immoral society, I recommend that you get married. Now, that's not a command, he says. It's a concession. But that's my recommendation. Get married and live a holy life in the midst of an ungodly society. Now, the question that some ask is celibacy okay, though? Some people are placed in a situation where that's a requirement. They lose a spouse. They never get married. And the celibate life is the life that's there. Paul says, yes, the celibate life is a good life. It's a fine life. And he'll argue later on in this same chapter, it's in some ways, it's a better life. But look what he says in verse 6 and 7. I say this by way of concession, not of command. You don't have to get married. Yet I wish that all men were even as I am. Paul lived a single life. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. Celibacy is a gift from God, according to Paul. The general rule, though, is marriage. The general rule, it's not good for man to be alone. But there are some people who have this gift and are able to live that way. In verse 8, Paul goes on to say, but I say to the unmarried and the widows, here are people that are called upon to live celibate lives. It's good for them if they remain, even as I am, a single celibate person. Now, we're going to go on next week, and we're going to look at this whole topic of divorce and remarriage. And I want to ask you to do something. I want to ask each of you during the week to read through this chapter and to try to make sense of it as best you can. Get a commentary out. Do some study on this. Talk with someone else about this particular passage. And come prepared next Sunday to be engaged in a discussion of the latter part of 1 Corinthians chapter 7. You may want to reference Matthew chapter 19. You need to go back and read what Jesus had to say about it as we compare that with what Paul has to say about it. Now, our goal in this congregation is to help marriages. I said at the very beginning, we're planning a seminar with Dr. Jones and his wife called Marriage Matters. And our elders are putting aside a sizable chunk of our budgetary giving toward this because they value marriages in this congregation and they know this is important. And we're going to really advertise it for the rest of this month. And we hope you'll be there and that you'll bring other couples to be there because we value marriages and the sanctity of marriage. And this congregation believes and teaches, and I preach regularly and it's taught in our classes, that we need to get married and we need to stay married until death parts us. But at the same time, we recognize that there are those for which that is no longer a reality. Divorce is part of this church family just like it's part of our society. And recognizing that, we want to help individuals who have gone through divorces and who are dealing with the baggage and the grief and the hardship of divorce. And that's one of the reasons why we have begun a support group for those who've been through divorce in this congregation. So we hold up the ideal, but we recognize because of human failings, we don't always live up to the ideal. And so we want to deal with that as well and be forgiving and loving and supportive when the ideal is not always reached. This morning, we all recognize that the ideal is frequently lost in our struggle with sin. All of us are sinners. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And we have a God who is a loving, forgiving Father. And so this morning, if there's anyone here who is struggling in any area of their life, we frequently pray for one another. And we'll pray for you this morning. If there's someone here who needs to take that initial step of faith by confessing Jesus, turning from sin, and being baptized, we'll gladly assist you as you take that step. If you need to come, we invite you to do that as we stand and sing.